by the benefit of this legislation.
The banking industry and Republican lawmakers oppose the legislation because it allows homeowners to sue banks with certain restrictions if wrongly foreclosed upon. Governor Jerry Brown is expected to sign the bill into law. For NPR News, I'm Amy Quinton in Sacramento.
Factory orders are showing some improvement, even though manufacturing overall has gone down. The Commerce Department says orders increased 0.7% in May. It was driven in part by higher demand for computers and machinery, but the U.S. exports are still affected by the slowdown in manufacturing in China and the European debt crisis. Dow up 57 points, NASDAQ gaining 22, and the S&P 500 up 8. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. The following program comes from the Focus Archives, which means for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
The Statue of Liberty is one of this country's most powerful symbols, yet when it arrived, packed in crates, in the late 1880s, no one could have imagined just how powerful this object would become. In this hour of Focus, we'll be getting the story of the small group of French intellectuals who decided to offer a tribute to American liberty on their side, and also on our side, the rather uphill fight for American support for the Statue of Liberty. This and a lot of other interesting facts can be found in a new book, which is titled The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. It is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Edward Berenson. He's professor of history, director of the Institute of French Studies, co-director of the Center for International Research in Humanities and Social Sciences at New York University. And he's someone who has been studying France and French history now for something like three decades. And Professor Berenson, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
Good.
Good. You know, my experience with the Statue of Liberty, it's only from seeing it in photographs.
Uh-huh.
And you, unlike maybe a lot of your fellow New Yorkers, actually have been there, have gone to see it. I'm sure it's the case that most people, you know, you don't go to see the sights of the place where you live. So I'm sure many New Yorkers, they don't go to see the Statue of Liberty. But you've gone. What is it like to see her in the flesh, so to speak?
You know, you really have to do it. You've got to see her close up. You've got to go inside. You have to take the boat ride. All my friends in New York, I tell them, they have to go. Foreign visitors, they know that they're supposed to go. But when you get on the boat, and you sort of chug your way toward the Statue of Liberty, it of course seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and you can't realize how huge the Statue of Liberty is until you're right at her feet. Also, one of the things that just startled me is the color. You know, from a distance, looks kind of like a sea grain color, you know, the color of oxidized copper, which is what her skin is made out of. But when you get close up, it's a much more beautiful color. It's a kind of almost a pastel green. And I was just really struck by the beauty of that color, which you really can't appreciate when you're just looking at the statue from a distance. The other thing that you can notice when you get up close is how it's built, and it's the skin of the Statue of Liberty. Its thickness is less than two pennies, made out of a copper, and you can actually see how the copper sheets are riveted together. When you get up close, you can see the rivets that hold together the couple hundred copper sheets that she's made out of. And so you miss all those things if you're just looking at it from a distance. And then when you go inside, you're really in for a treat because you can see the skeleton. The skeleton was created by Gustave Eiffel, the man who created the Eiffel Tower. And in a funny sort of way, there is an Eiffel Tower inside the Statue of Liberty. That is the same construction materials, the same form of engineering forms the metal skeleton that holds the Statue of Liberty up. You know, she's not solid. And when you go inside, you can actually appreciate the really extraordinary work of engineering, especially when you think about the fact that the thing was built over 125 years ago. You can really appreciate what a feat of engineering it is. And then, you know, you make the climb. It's a little arduous. The stairway is really narrow. But you make the climb to the top, and it's really worth doing because you have the most spectacular view of New York City, the New York Harbor, all the major bridges, and the really beautiful Verrazano Narrows Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge, and you can only see that view from the Statue of Liberty. Mm.
I hadn't really looked at the statistics before, but was surprised to realize just how big it is. The statue itself is the height of a 15-story building,
right.
And then she's sitting on the brick base, and the whole thing is, I think, like 300 feet tall. So that's like a 30-story building. This is a big thing.
It's a really big thing, and that's the point. You know, when the French sculptor Frédéric Bartholdi conceived of the thing, I mean, he conceived of it as the largest statue in the world, and that it would be colossal, and that it would resemble the colossal statues that were created in the ancient world. And you know, he wanted it to be so big that you couldn't possibly miss it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're so used to it that one of the things we get used to really is its colossal size. And that's one of the things that you really appreciate when you take the boat and you get up close. Mm-hmm. And you see just how big it is.
One of the things that you argue that perhaps it has made it so receptive to various meanings is the fact that it's actually not a particularly great work of art. Even
right.
Bartholdi himself admitted that it was not a particularly great work of art.
Right. It was basically a kind of standard issue Greco-Roman goddess of liberty. And in France especially, but other parts of Europe too, starting with the French Revolution, these goddesses of liberty were really common symbols. During the French Revolution, there were all kinds of goddesses of liberty to represent all different phases and versions of the French Revolution, a moderate version, a more radical version, a middle-of-the-row version, different forms of the goddess of liberty emerged then to express this idea of freedom, which the French Revolution enshrined, and then France had a whole series of revolutions in the 19th century, and each time there was a new revolution, there were new versions of this. And so as an idea for a piece of sculpture, the Statue of Liberty was fairly banal. And that, paradoxically, its very banality, its abstractness, you know, it doesn't represent any kind of real individual. It's not a statue of anybody. And because it's kind of banal artistically and because it's abstract, that means that it's been relatively easy for different people at different times to impose different meanings on it. And so it's kind of an open thing, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Statue of Liberty has just remained such an important symbol, because in a way we can always keep it up to date.
We have a caller here we'll bring into the conversation. Let me just very quickly again introduce the guest, Edward Berenson. He's professor of history at New York University, is interested in and has studied France and French history for a long time. He is the author of a recently published book that looks at the story of the Statue of Liberty, something of how it came to be and how it is that people, and particularly in this country, have thought of it over the years. It's published by the Yale University Press. Questions welcome, and we have somebody here ready to go in Belgium, not the country, but the town that's not all that far away from us, here on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. I grew up in a military family, and in like 1955, 54, I floated into New York Harbor and saw Statue of Liberty out of my porthole. Father says, "Look at this," you know, did, and then we proceeded. After a few days in New York, we went out to the island in winter, and like you say, it just gets more and more impressive as you get to it. However, in a young man's mind, a young boy's mind, actually at that point in time, the thing that impressed me the most was the walk up through the inside.
Yeah.
And we went up to the crown. You could no longer go to the arm at that time, I don't think.
No, you couldn't.
Yeah. But we went up to the crown, and then you overlooked all of New York, it seemed like, and we came back down, and it stayed with me for years and years. But here recently, I understand that that's not possible anymore.
I thought it actually was, but you had to get special permission, and it was a long wait.
What you're thinking of probably is after 9/11, the interior of the Statue of Liberty was closed for several years because the National Park Service that's in charge of it wanted to beef up the security on the inside. But it did reopen briefly, and it was open for a little more than a year, and it's now closed for further renovations. But as I understand it, it's going to reopen for good this coming November.
Then I'm sure in these closures, they really took away one of the most spectacular aspects of a young boy's walk. It was a open great mesh stairway that you walked up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of rickety, and it just kept going up and up and
right.
up. Now I'm sure there's probably going to be an elevator or something, but...
Well, there's an elevator that goes up to the top of the pedestal, but when you get into the statue itself, no, it's just this narrow, winding staircase. It's been upgraded some because there was a major restoration of the Statue of Liberty in the 1980s for the centennial, and so they upgraded the staircase a little bit, but it's a pretty narrow space in there, and so... If you were to visit it again, I think all those memories would come back. It's not all that different. And a lot of people find that climb, especially the climb down, terrifying.
You know, it definitely impressed me.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I learned just in researching the book is how vivid people's memories are, especially people like you who came in as a young person, as an immigrant.
No, I was not an immigrant.
Not again, uh-huh.
My father was in the military. And
I see, okay.
When you travel overseas, you had to come back by boat.
I see, so you were just coming back home.
And we were coming back home.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, there are a lot of those stories, too, as people who've traveled abroad and spent a fair amount of time abroad, and the feeling of being home when you see the Statue of Liberty. And so that's for Americans. That's a really vivid thing, and your experience is a pretty common one. And then for immigrants, also a really powerful experience to see the Statue of Liberty from the porthole or from the deck of a boat, and to realize that they're finally here.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions and comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You'd mentioned the fact that there have been, particularly, I guess, and it would be in the 19th century, other representations of this, the quote-unquote goddess of liberty.
Right.
And that the French have Marianne, and that we had Columbia,
right.
And that there were certain kinds of similarities between them. Having said that, though, was there something about the particular design here, the figure of the Statue of Liberty, that Americans looked at and they really weren't quite sure about?
Well, there were a couple of things. One is that these goddesses of liberty were not common in this country. And in fact, just building public monuments wasn't a very common thing in the 19th century. We had a new country, and we didn't really have the resources to spend very much on public art. And especially in the 19th century, we were a very practically minded people. And so we didn't do this kind of thing. And so when this French guy came to the United States, not speaking a word of English, and he proposed to build this colossal goddess of liberty here, an awful lot of people thought it was kind of a presumptuous thing. You know, who is this guy who wants to put up something so large in the harbor of our major city without consulting anybody beforehand? And so there was a lot of skepticism and even a fair amount of hostility toward the idea at first, because Americans just weren't familiar with this kind of thing. And there's always something unsettling about an unsolicited gift. You know, well, what do they want in return is what people in this country were thinking, you know. Or is if we accept this gift, does it sort of, are we going to be honor-bound to give the French something in return? And in a way, that sort of concern made sense, because the French people who were behind this idea did have some ulterior motives. I mean, they were relatively positive motives, in the sense that what they wanted was for the United States to remain on friendly terms with France. And there's the group of people in France who first conceived of the Statue of Liberty were really worried that France and the United States were pulling apart. They came up with the idea of giving this kind of gift to the United States in the 1860s, when France was ruled by Napoleon III, who was the nephew of the great Napoleon. And Napoleon III's foreign policy was not at all pro-American, and were certainly not pro-Union, because Napoleon III had kind of designs on Mexico. He sent an expeditionary force to Mexico to try to colonize the country, and he was looking for a weak and divided United States. And so during the Civil War, Napoleon III supported the South, because he thought that a weak and united and divided United States would present less of a threat for Napoleon III's designs on Mexico. And the sort of liberal-minded Frenchmen who supported the idea of a Statue of Liberty, they were horrified by Napoleon III's foreign policy, because they were supporters of the North. They were abolitionists. They hated slavery. And they worried that after the Civil War was over and the North was victorious, of course, they were afraid that people in this country would remember that a French government had not supported the Union. And so these French political and intellectual figures, one of them was the brother of de Tocqueville, another was a grandson of Lafayette, so these were people who had strong ties to the United States and really, really very close feelings, warm feelings toward the United States. And so what they wanted to do is sort of to demonstrate to Americans that the French really did support the United States, believe in the United States, and wanted to be close to the United States. And the other thing that these French figures who wanted to be friendly with the United States were, they were afraid that the U.S., as it began to industrialize and become an economic powerhouse, they were afraid that the United States' commercial and economic relationships would be with the two stronger European economies, and those were the British and the German economies. And the French were starting to fall behind in the late 19th century. And so one of the reasons for this French gesture toward the United States was to remind the U.S. that France was there, was really eager to have commercial and political relationships with the United States, and also to remind the Americans that the French had played a major role in the American Revolution, and that the American public should remember that French role and express some gratitude for it. Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of other callers here. We'll continue to talk with folks here. Of course, talk with our guest, Edward Berenson from New York University. We're talking about some of the history behind the Statue of Liberty. And questions welcome. Let's go to Piatone as the next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I love this topic. Reason being is I'm first-generation American. Uh-huh. My family came over here from that, and they always idolized that ideal behind the Statue of Liberty, and as well as my wife's. the thing that is kind of sad is it seems like it's kind of tarnished nowadays. It doesn't mean a lot to some people nowadays as it did 100 years ago. I think in the 40s and 50s, then, is the last time the meeting really stuck to our country. Now it's open to everybody and everything. There isn't, you know, the ideal of things, it slowly seems to be losing. And I know my relatives back in the old country are kind of laughing at us for trying to go a route that they've already been at. And it's kind of, you know, I like the history behind it, but nowadays it's like the statues are kind of being made for like a president, you know, and a sitting president, be it whether present or in the past, and making it more important than the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty is not a person. It's a ideal. And
right.
People think that every statue that's ever made has got to be of some famous person or something that, and I think that's wrong. I think the whole idea of America is for the liberty.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you. And I guess I have a little bit more optimistic or positive view of how the Statue of Liberty has continued to have meaning for us. One of the things that you can think about is in 1989 in Tiananmen Square, when Chinese students and other people sort of rose up in rebellion against the communist regime and wanted to express their desire for liberty and democracy, what did they do? They built a version of the Statue of Liberty to symbolize their aspirations for freedom. And so I think that's one of the things that we can see is that the Statue of Liberty has continued to have meaning not just for us here, but for people all around the world. And there's this incredible photograph. I didn't publish it in my book because I couldn't get the rights to it. But there's this amazing photograph from the Tiananmen Square demonstrations where the Statue of Liberty that the students put up is facing a gigantic portrait of Chairman Mao. You know, as if to say, you know, you're the past, and I, Liberty, am the present and future. So I think there's that. And I also would say that since 9/11, this Statue of Liberty has taken on a kind of renewed meaning. And they're disturbing, but they're also important photographs of the Statue of Liberty safe and sound across the harbor from the Twin Towers on fire. And I think that image is stuck in people's mind because it now kind of represents the resilience of our country and of New York City in the face of these terrible attacks that we experienced. And some of the motives for the attacks were that we had liberty. And so I think that since 9/11, there's a whole new appreciation of American liberty and of the Statue of Liberty for representing that.
All right. We go on to another caller. Champaign County next. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. The inscription, I think, is being overlooked. It's liberty, not just a symbol of U.S. liberty or something envied around the world, but it's also invitation for huddled masses to arrive on the shore, which is not something that's very part of the zeitgeist of the U.S. right now. So,
no, that's true. And you know, the "Give me your huddled mass, your tired, your poor, your huddled masses" was not part of the original conception of the Statue of Liberty. It came later, and it was a poem, as you know, written by Emma Lazarus, and it didn't get kind of engraved onto the Statue of Liberty until after 1900, and it didn't even really become a prominent part of the Statue of Liberty's meaning and symbolism until the 1930s. But as you say, it's a really, really important thing because what it says to the world is that we welcome you to come here.
Actually, I didn't know that. I'm happy to know that. I didn't know that part of the history. But I actually, my question incited me to call was something I'd heard about the French who were thinking of giving this gift, that I assume that there's probably some differences amongst them, and
yep.
There was one story that it was sort of two revolutionary states communing, and that there was the idea that Marianne actually would be the statue that would be sent. And I've always been amused by that. You're probably going to slap it down, but
that's an important part of the story.
Bare-breasted.
Very few people in this
bare-breasted
know this, but they're. You know, basically, there were two really prominent versions of the Goddess of Liberty, a radical one, Marianne, and there's the Delacroix painting, Liberty Leading the People, and you have this Goddess of Liberty who is, you know, has a fierce expression on her face, and her hair is flowing, and it's kind of erotic, you know, her gown is falling down, and her breasts are exposed, and it really stands for this sort of radical revolution that's going to turn things upside down. But then there's a much more sedate version of the Goddess of Liberty. And in those versions that appeared prominently in France in around 1848, you have the Statue of Liberty seated with a calm expression on her face, fully clothed, so there's nothing erotic about it. And it's the second, more sedate version of Liberty that that Bartholdi, the sculptor, and the Americans who supported the idea, that's the one that they favored, because they were not at all happy about the kind of radical, violent French revolutionary tradition. They wanted the calmer, what they considered to be the calmer, the more sedate, the more orderly version of Liberty that Tocqueville wrote about in his book. And it was that version of Liberty that the French founders of, the French originators of the Statue of Liberty wanted to emphasize, and that's the one that the American people, for the most part, who supported it, wanted to see. Sedate version, not Marianne.
Was there, though, not some of the reluctance on the American part was this concern that the statue did represent or might represent this, what they would consider to be this dangerous, radical spirit.
Right, right. That there are an awful lot of people in this country who didn't make the distinction between a radical version of Liberty and a more moderate one. And they were afraid that any French representation of Liberty would have revolutionary implications, and so that there was a fair number of people in this country who were afraid that by accepting the Statue of Liberty, we would be endorsing a radical French version of Liberty and not a much more moderate American one. And that kind of battle between a more kind of activist, radical form of Liberty and a more moderate one, that stayed in force in this country for a long time. When the Statue of Liberty first went up in this country in 1886, that was the middle of a huge strike wave, and one of the most remarkable incidents is one that happened not too far from you in Chicago in the Haymarket, mm-hmm. where there was a general strike of working people and big demonstrations, and shots got fired, and no one knows exactly. Never been established who set off the first shots, but there were some deaths, and there were eight people, demonstrators who had been associated with radical labor movements, were put on trial, and four of them suffered the death penalty. And just the trial took place just a couple of weeks before the unveiling of the Statue of Liberty in New York, and the wife of one of the guys who was condemned to die got up in the courtroom and said, we're putting up a Statue to Liberty, but the way that you have this travesty of justice, she said, that is directed against my husband, shows that we don't really have liberty in this country.
In this hour of focus, our guest is Edward Berenson. He's professor of history at New York University. He's interested in the history of France and is the author of a recent book, which is about the history of the Statue of Liberty. And it's titled Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story. It's published by the Yale University Press. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think in the book you write that there are a number of things that people think about the statue that aren't really true.
Right.
One of them being that it was a gift from the French government to the American government.
Right. That's a really common idea.
Which is not true.
And in fact, neither government had anything to do with it. As I mentioned earlier, the statue was conceived as a gesture against a French government that was authoritarian, and for that reason, the government of Napoleon III in the 1860s wasn't at all wild about the idea of putting up a Statue of Liberty, because he knew it was designed to, the idea was designed to criticize his own government. And so all the money that came to build the Statue of Liberty was raised from private sources, fundraising campaigns, and then as the different parts of the statue went up, head got built and was displayed in the Paris World's Fair in 1878, and so people were charged admissions to go up to the top of the head, and that went toward financing the rest of it, and the photographs and postcards got sold, that kind of thing, and so just it took 5 years to raise the money from private sources to build the thing. And the informal agreement between the French promoters and then the Americans who got on board was that the Americans would be responsible for building the pedestal. And so the U.S. Congress did agree in 1877 to make available space on a little island in New York Harbor, then called Bedloe's Island, it's now called Liberty Island, to make that space available to the French sculptor to put up his work. But there was an effort to get a $100,000 appropriation to help finance the pedestal, and that got voted down in Congress in 1877. And then there was a bill in the New York State Legislature a few years later that then Governor Grover Cleveland vetoed. That was a $50,000 appropriation. And so there, too, the money to build the pedestal came from private sources, from fundraising. And in fact, it's not clear that the U.S. people were going to be able to come up with the money had it not been for the intervention of Joseph Pulitzer, the newspaper publisher, who had a popular paper, and he started it in St. Louis, created the Post-Dispatch, and then went to New York and bought a paper there, the New York World, and he opened a campaign, and it was a kind of populist campaign. It was partly designed to up his circulation, to sell papers, but it was partly because he really believed in the meaning of the Statue of Liberty and its importance. And so he basically told his readers, he said, look, there's a blue blood committee of New Yorkers who are trying to raise money, and they're not doing it. And the rich are not contributing. Maybe they're afraid of what liberty might symbolize. And so let's us, the ordinary people, the regular working people, let's us contribute the money. And so he said, send in your nickels, dimes, and quarters. And Pulitzer said, I'm going to publish in my newspaper the name of every single person who contributes. And if you write a letter with your contribution, I might publish that too. Pulitzer did all those things, although we think that he probably made up some of the letters. It's really impossible to know how authentic they are. I think it's pretty clear that many of them aren't. But what happened was over 120,000 individual people contributed just over $100,000, and that's what put the pedestal fundraising campaign over the top and made it possible for the Statue of Liberty to go up. Well, and it actually sat there. Statue of Liberty was finished a good long time, a couple of years before the money was in place to build the pedestal. And so when the Statue of Liberty was shipped over here from Paris, it was in 200 and some shipping containers, and it sat there. All those shipping containers sat there for a year or so on Bedloe's Island while we were waiting to come up with the money to pay for this pedestal.
Yeah. I was just going to say here again that we have about 10 minutes left maybe in the show, and questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can email us as well, and that is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, what was the initial, once it was finally up and completed and people could see what it looked like, what was the initial reaction?
Well, the main reaction was that people were thrilled, and it was a gigantic celebration, and parades through New York City. The firemen, the policemen, all kinds of people were out there. There were as many as a million people who were out on the streets. They obviously couldn't go out to the island, but they paraded down Fifth Avenue to welcome the statue. By then, this is, we're talking October of 1886, Grover Cleveland is president, and he decides that he now wants to participate in the celebration. And so he becomes a proponent of the Statue of Liberty, goes out to the island, gives a major speech about the importance of liberty and how the United States represents liberty, and that's why we're so thrilled to accept this statue. And you got to keep in mind that just a couple of years earlier, Grover Cleveland, as governor of New York, had vetoed an appropriation to help pay for the pedestal. But once it was up, Cleveland was on board. So the establishment of the time and an awful lot of just ordinary people were thrilled by the presence of this great statue in New York Harbor, but there were a fair number of people who were not happy about it. The people who believed that the United States didn't have the liberty that it claimed to have. And so there were suffragists, women who wanted the right to vote, and of course women in the late 19th century didn't yet have the right to vote, and they actually staged a demonstration right during the ceremony unveiling the Statue of Liberty that a group called the Women's Suffrage Organization chartered a boat, and they sailed out toward Bedloe's Island. Because as you can imagine, there weren't very many women who were invited to the official ceremony. And so this group of women's suffrage advocates sailed their boat out to the island, and they had a megaphone, and they shouted out, "How can we have a woman that symbolizes liberty at a time when women don't have liberty in this country?" And then the African American press had a similar point of view. On the one hand, the black-owned newspapers and their editors were thrilled about the idea of symbolizing liberty for all. But at the same time, they typically said things like, "But people of African origins in this country, even though slavery has been abolished, we have Jim Crow laws, we have lynchings." In the 1880s, when the Statue of Liberty went up, there was an average of 2 lynchings a week in this country, and so there was a sense that the United States was not living up to the ideals of liberty that the Statue of Liberty represented, and there was an effort to point this out. Mm-hmm. We had some work to do in a way before we sort of merited this great statue.
I think a little earlier you made the reference to the poem that I think many people will be familiar with, or at least a few lines of it, by Emma Lazarus,
right,
which is engraved. It's on a plaque which is there at the monument, and this is the poem where the lines come from: "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." And people, I think, associate the statue with this welcoming attitude towards immigrants. Well, I'm not exactly sure that throughout the statue's history, that's what it represented to people.
Yeah. That was one of the things that I was most amazed to find out when I did the research for the book. For the one thing that Bartholdi and the other French creators of the Statue of Liberty, they weren't thinking about immigration at all. That the
their first idea was that the Statue of Liberty would symbolize the freedom of the slaves, the end of slavery. And then once the Reconstruction had happened and the Civil War and slavery were somewhat in the background, then the statue would represent just liberty, the ideals of liberty. And Emma Lazarus was really the first person to make explicit the idea that the Statue of Liberty would be about welcome to immigrants. And she wrote that poem as part of the fundraising effort to come up with the money to build the pedestal. Artists and writers were asked to contribute a work that would be then auctioned off, and the proceeds would go to for the fundraising effort. And so she wrote the poem for that purpose, but this was at the beginning of a massive wave of immigration, the 1880s, 90s, first decade of the 20th century. Millions and millions and millions of people came, mostly from Europe, to this country, and the immigration was very, very controversial, just as it is nowadays. And part of the reason then, as now, why immigration was controversial is that in the late 19th century, like now, economic times were hard. There was pretty high unemployment, and there was a big worry that immigrants would take jobs away from people who were already here. And so, bizarrely, some of the most prominent imagery surrounding the Statue of Liberty in the early years, and I'm talking the early 1890s, was anti-immigrant. And the Statue of Liberty was represented in a whole lot of political cartoons and other poems that were much more famous than Emma Lazarus's poem, much more famous at the time. We've forgotten them now. But there was a lot of writing about the Statue of Liberty as protecting the United States against all the unwashed who were coming in, all the foreigners who were not wanted by a pretty large number of people in this country. And so there are a couple of famous political cartoons where there's the Statue of Liberty and a ship floats into the frame and it says European garbage ship. And people are being shoveled at the Statue of Liberty's feet, and she's kind of hiking up her skirts because she doesn't want to be sullied by all these people who are coming in. And so the Statue of Liberty in these early images is represented as being adverse to all the immigrants coming in and as playing a role in protecting the United States against them. Mm-hmm. It's not really until after the turn of the 20th century, and really not until the 1930s, that the general view of the Statue of Liberty as being a positive symbol of immigration, of representing the greatness of this country as a country of welcome. Not until the 1930s that becomes a pretty general view among Americans.
Yeah, there are a couple of those images that are here in the book, the one that you mentioned and another one that was from a newspaper, the Evening Telegram, with the Statue of Liberty holding her nose,
right,
and around the base there are various figures of people from outside the United States, and it's in big letters. It's written "The Dregs of Europe." It's
right.
It's really, really striking to
see.
They're
pretty startling, aren't they?
Yes,
those images.
Yes.
And there were the Secretary of Interior at the time decided, this is in 1890, decided that there were so many people coming in that we needed to have a, kind of an immigrant processing station. And this later became Ellis Island, but at the time, the Secretary of Interior's idea was he was going to put that immigrant processing station on the same island as the Statue of Liberty. And that just raised a gigantic ruckus, including from Bartoldi, the sculptor of the Statue of Liberty himself, who said that, "I never had any idea of associating the Statue of Liberty with immigration, and it would be a travesty to put the immigration reception station in the same place as the Statue of Liberty." And that's why Ellis Island became what it was, because it was geographically separate from the Statue of Liberty, and that if it didn't satisfy people, at least didn't horrify people who did not want to associate the Statue of Liberty with the waves of immigration at the time.
Because of the way that the statue was constructed, as you explained, that it's the skin, the part that we actually see, is quite right. thin, and it is hung on a structure that was devised by Gustav Eiffel
right.
long before he built the Eiffel Tower. So that's on the inside that holds it up. Because of the way that it was constructed, it was actually possible for the entire thing to be built and then taken down and shipped over to the United States. So there was a point where they're in Paris or on the edge of Paris, wherever they found the room to do it. She was set up full size altogether.
Yep. Well, that's not something else that's not all that well known in this country. It's even not all that well known in France. But the Statue of Liberty stood fully assembled in Paris for about 2 years. And the idea was that it was going to be built there, and it was built in a really modern way, kind of in sections that were numbered, and so it could be put up and then taken down and reassembled. And since the artisans who built it were all there and they were experienced in the techniques of creating these really thin wafers of copper, it was a really skilled enterprise that not very many people knew how to do. And so Bartoli, the sculptor, hired all his people there in Paris, and then one of the people he brought into the project early on was Eiffel, because he was famous for building bridges that could span a much greater distance than the bridges to date. And that was because he figured out how to create iron arches that would sway with the wind and would absorb some of the wind rather than being buffeted by it. And Eiffel used exactly those techniques when he built the skeleton that holds up the Statue of Liberty. And in a lot of ways, Eiffel's work on the Statue of Liberty was a dress rehearsal for the Eiffel Tower itself. Mm-hmm. That if you were to kind of unzip the copper skin of the Statue of Liberty, you would see something that looks a lot like the Eiffel Tower inside.
So when she was once there set up for those 2 years there in Paris, she I mentioned at the beginning of the program, she's 150 feet tall. Were there many things, were she taller than a lot of the rest of the built environment there?
Yeah. The Statue of Liberty just towered over Paris, which was a really low-rise city. There was a major redevelopment of Paris that took place in the 1850s and 1860s, and most of the buildings were limited to 7 stories, and so the Statue of Liberty just standing on the ground over 15 stories high, and so it was twice as tall as the tallest structures, and everybody saw it, and it actually became a major tourist attraction. All kinds of people went, and this, by the time we're in the 1880s, France has a republic that's similar in structure to the government of this country, and so by then the French government is completely favorable to it. And so the French president goes out and pays a visit. Some of its most famous artists, the great poet and writer Victor Hugo, went out to see the Statue of Liberty and wrote about it. And in fact, when Bartoli started dismantling it to send it over to the United States, there were a lot of Parisians who were really unhappy about it. They didn't want to see it go. And there were editorials in the newspapers. I mean, they weren't hostile or angry editorials, but they were saying, you know, we'd like to have a Statue of Liberty for ourselves. And in fact, that's one reason why the American expatriate community in Paris, a few years after the statue was put up here in New York, the American community of Paris, they financed a replica of the Statue of Liberty and put it up on a little island in the Seine River. Basically, as a thank you to the French.
I want to try real quick to get in one last caller here. We'll have to ask them to be brief, but we'll do that in Champagne. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You may have covered this, but whose idea was it to put that beautiful poem by Emma Lazarus on the base? Was it Pulitzer or Emma Lazarus or whose?
You know, it's a really good question, because that the poem really was forgotten after she wrote it in 1883, and it was basically Emma Lazarus died very young. She was 37 years old, and it's a really great loss to the country. And so, some of her friends basically did for the inclusion of the poem and the Statue of Liberty right after the turn of the century.
Well, you know, we're going to have to stop. I just want to say, by the way, that there are photographs of Liberty in Paris. They're so odd looking. It looks, you look at it and you think, well, that has to be photoshopped. That couldn't possibly be real. It just seems so unreal to see her there. But you can, if you go on the web, you can actually see pictures of what it looked like when she was there in Paris.
Yeah. One of the things that Bartholdi wanted to do, he had the construction process really elaborately photographed because he wanted people to remember that it started out in Paris.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story. More of it can be found in the book, The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story, published by the Yale University Press, by our guest, Edward Berenson. He's a professor of history at New York University. And thank you very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure.
That conversation was originally broadcast on June 29th of this year. And, of course, you can hear all of our Focus programs online anytime at will.illinois.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, what if you're barbecuing fish and it slips through the grill? What do you do?
Do you have a cat? Because that cat's going to eat well. You're pretty much done. At that point, you've sacrificed the fish to the charcoal gods.
Advice from Bridget Lancaster and Christopher Kimball of America's Test Kitchen. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
And coming up on Focus in the next few days, well, first of all, tomorrow we'll step away for some July 4th specials for you. We'll have the Capitol Steps Politics Takes a Holiday 4th of July special at 10 a.m. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, it's Backstory with the American History Guys with a special entitled Independence Days. That's D-A-Z-E, a history of July 4th. On Thursday, we'll listen back to a conversation from May of this year with Dr. Gary Allen Fine. He's a Northwestern University sociologist. He's written a book entitled The Global Grapevine, Why Rumors of Terrorism, Immigration, and Trade Matter. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Daphne Sheldrick, a Kenyan conservationist, about her book, Love, Life, and Elephants, An African Love Story. And on Friday, we'll have a conversation from May of this year with an author of the book Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Then we'll follow that with a conversation with Duke University professor of engineering discussing his book To Forgive Design, Understanding Failure, in which he looks at the ways that people and machines come together in ways designers never anticipated until it was too late. Those are the conversations that you'll hear ahead this week on Focus. Now let's take a look at what's happening on the commodity markets at this hour. The latest tick from Kansas City for July wheat, 780 and a quarter. That's up 20 and three quarters. September wheat's at 800, up 23. Chicago wheat for July is at 782, up 27 and a half. September wheat's at 799 and a quarter, up 26 and three quarters. July corn's at 717 and three quarters, up 25 and a quarter. September corn at 674 and a quarter, up 22. July soybeans trading at 1574 and three quarters, up 42 and a half. August beans at 1532 and a half, up 38 and a quarter. July soybean meals trading at 455, up 1250. August soybean meal at 447.50, up 1220. July soybean oil is trading at 52.89, up 71 cents. August soybean oil at 53.10, up 74 cents. August live cattle is at 119.57 and a half, up 30. October live cattle at 123.55, up 20. August feeder cattle at 147.67 and a half is down make that 147.60 down 205. September feeder cattle at 150.85 down $1.87.5. July lean hogs are trading at 96.80. That's down 10 cents. August lean hogs at 94.95, down 2.5 cents in trading on the day. There is an excessive heat warning in effect until 7 o'clock Saturday, and a heat advisory in effect for Ford County starting, well, actually started about an hour ago, until 9 o'clock tomorrow night. Mostly sunny, hot, and humid in Champaign-Urbana today. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon with a high 98 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear, the low 75. Tomorrow, sunny, very hot, the high around 100.